Morning, folks. So I thought to myself, this group is way too passive. I need to stir some controversy. So now I feel better. Conflict. I'm much more comfortable with conflict. Anyway, I'll only do this once, but even though I'm a Bostonian again now, once again I've cycled back, I'm a Bucks fan too, so go Bucks. Maybe this is the year. You Reds fans, whoever you are, have had your time. Indians, I know, it's a struggle. But Tito, though, we sent you Tito, so from Boston, right? The manager. Well, you're clearly gluttons for punishment. It's Wednesday and you're still here, so I guess that means keep going, right? Don't turn back now. Do you know, he's not one of my favorite historical figures, but Winston Churchill was a pretty witty guy. And I heard a story about him once that he was at this testimonial for him, and one of his former teachers stood up and said, "Winston, it's great what you've accomplished. You're a great man and so forth, but I have one concern, and that is there are rumors that you like your drink." And in fact, the teacher said, "I've heard something like," and she pointed to a spot on the wall, "that if we fill this room with everything you've drunk since I had you in class, it would go right up to the middle of that wall. Is that true?" And Churchill looked over at that point, looked from there to the ceiling, and he said, "So much to do and so little time in which to do it." So he's a pretty witty guy, maybe. Not my favorite, but so that's the way I feel. Although we do accomplish a lot in the talkbacks that we can't accomplish here. So, as I've been doing, I hope this is okay. I'm going to clean up a little from what I didn't finish yesterday. And one issue that really got raised nicely in the talkback, and I'll try to deal with it, and then move on to today's topic, which is more specifically the relationship between religion and politics. Religion and politics, which I think is a lot of confusion about. Anyway, so yesterday we talked about five types. Our social justice empowerment people talk about five types of being involved in social justice issues, education, service, witness, advocacy, and community organizing. The last two of which really try to get at bigger issues of social change, not just charity work, but justice work, changing things through legislation or through organizing people, organizing power and so forth. So a few people asked me about, so how about picking issues in a congregation? How does that work? And we do have a process for it. So just a couple of caveats. You know, we can't do it all. Someone told me earlier in the week that in their church, the social justice team tries to affirm everyone who's got some project going. So they try to support all these little projects. That's a nice thing. And it fits nicely into UU individualism, right? We all have our projects and the Social Justice Committee supports it. But it wouldn't, what we encourage you to do is also try to find an issue or two that the entire congregation can embrace if possible. So you have this experience of collective work, uniting, coming up with an issue. It won't always be your issue or your issue, but collectively working on an issue if you can do it. Some issues are too divisive. We can't agree to them. And so you move on to that. But there are issues that you can work on. And one surfaced yesterday probably at the talkback around environmental justice, environmental concerns, one of the huge issues, if not the huge issue of the 21st century, certainly maybe around that. And lastly, you know, there's this question of congregational voting. You know, when we pick an issue as a congregation, we have the democratic process, which I understand. But I have to admit, sometimes that can really get bogged down. I always like looking for consensus. So you get consensus, I think, by doing a lot of survey ahead of time, so you have a sense what the congregation cares about, and you've already narrowed it down. And if through that survey you actually one issue keeps coming up and up and up again, then that team, the social justice team, might even present that. You know, we did a survey, and this issue just kept coming up, and we're suggesting that we take on this issue, and so forth. Congregational votes, particularly if we're scattered and so forth, can be so disappointing when you don't win and so forth. So I like to avoid those if possible. Now, when you're picking issues, one of the things we suggest in our justice empowerment work is that there are certain criteria that you look at as you're picking issues that we suggest to every congregation. And it comes under the acronym of GAFO, GAFO. I suppose you could say GAFAW, but just to be silly. But GAFO, G-A-F-O, GAFO. And the acronym stands for Grounding, Accountability, Fit, and Opportunity. So very, very quickly, grounding. Is this issue, when it surfaces, is it grounded in UU values, UU theology? Now, I know everyone doesn't like the word theology. It's my word, it works for me, others, but I know it does. So UU values, what ultimately you care about, Paul Tillich would say, ultimate value. So is the issue grounded in UU values? Do we have a history with this? Have we spoken about it? Has the General Assembly passed legislation? Blah, 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 blah. So is it grounded? Is it solidly grounded in our values and theology? That's not too tough a one because we're so pluralistic. You know, we ground lots of things in our values and theology. But still, it's a good question to ask. And it fits with my theme of grounding our social justice work in our values, in our theology. Always the first question. You know, it's not about being a Democrat or Republican, as we spoke, but it's about being a UU with a certain set of values. Secondly, accountability. And this is, and I think the Latin Americans, as I mentioned in the first day, talked a lot about this whole idea of solidarity with people who are oppressed. Solidarity with the oppressed. Many of us in this group may feel oppressed or be oppressed. So this question of when we pick an issue, how does that issue relate to the community, whatever that community we define, is disenfranchised, is a victim of oppression. And I like to think of it when I was at Allegheny and now at Essex, I like to think that the community out there, particularly the disenfranchised community, however we name it, helps us decide our issues. We don't do it just internally. What do we care about this group of 90 or 150? But what about the community out there? What are their issues, particularly those who are suffering deep oppression for whatever reason? So accountability to particularly the oppressed. Third, is it a fit? And by that, this is very pragmatic. Do we have the resources to really make a difference? Is there really widespread interest in the congregation? Or is it just a couple of people and it's going to die out? Is there real passion in the congregation? So does it really fit? You know, there are a lot of issues that if you ask people, do you care about it, they raise their hand. But then if you ask, well, who's going to work on this? And then only three people raise their hand. Then you know maybe it's not a fit. Or you don't have the resources, and resources being human resources and not just, you know, financial. So is it a fit? And then lastly, is there an opportunity? Is it the right moment for this issue? So there are lots of great issues out there. And let's say you're trying to affect legislation. You may have this wonderful issue, but you've checked with your congressperson, and she has said to you, there isn't a snowball's chance in hell that's going through Congress this year. It just isn't. There's no support for it. I've checked it out, and so forth and so on. So you could be prophetic and still take on that issue and build the long term. But generally speaking, we like victories and success. So generally speaking, there are enough issues out there where the moment might be right. You know, for many years, in different parts of the country, like in Massachusetts now, raising the minimum wage or even talking about living wage, the opportunity wasn't there. We kept getting, or raising taxes, that's a big one. We kept getting the impression, no, it's not going to go through. There's this anti-tax thing and so forth, so don't raise it. It's going to go nowhere, okay? The opportunity's not there. So at least raise that issue. Is it an opportune moment? So GAFO, grounding, accountability, fit, an opportunity. Just something to help you discern the issues for yourselves. The second thing that came up in the talkback session is, you know, we've been throwing around the term justice and social justice. And, of course, always, especially with UUs, well, what do you mean by that? How would you define that? You know, and they say, oh, nuts. Some things you like to presume, but no, I'm joking about that. No, of course we have to define what we mean. And tomorrow, we'll probably really get things going controversially because we'll talk about who gets to define justice. That, in some ways, is a bigger issue, I think, than in the abstract, what is justice? Who gets to define? Which is to say, from whose perspective do we look at justice? And that gets a little dicey. Someone might even leave the room on that one. Well, we'll see. But anyway, what we said yesterday about justice, this is pretty simple, actually. And I'm sort of I like to look at the ancient philosophers and the medievalists and so forth, what they said about it. And what I understand about justice is simply it's about right relationship. Right relationship. Yeah, what does that mean? Well, let me tell you a quick story, very quickly. So I'm in the seminary in the mid-70s, Northeast Washington, Dominican House of Studies, Catholic University. I get on a bus once a week, go down to the soup kitchen, the Center for Center for Creative Nonviolence was a group, great group. A fellow named Mitch Snyder was part of that group. Ed Guinan, Kathleen Guinan, wonderful, wonderful activists. Anyway, mid-70s, I go down once a week on the bus to the soup kitchen. And so I get there early. We start preparing soup and so forth. And the folks aren't going to be coming in for a little while. And we're almost ready with our soup. And folks start filing in. And I have in my back pocket a little book I read on the bus on the way down. And it's a book by a Catholic giant named Karl Rahner on prayer and spirituality. And all of a sudden, I feel this tug in the back of my pocket, you know, and someone whips out this book. And he looks at it with disdain. And he said, well, what's... And he asked me a question, which I'm embarrassed about, but I'm going to be honest, I'll share it. He says to me, tell me something that you don't care very much about. Oh, I don't care very much about it. I said, and I'm sorry, I apologize ahead of time. Ballet, I said. That's what I said. I have to own it. I'm not very interested in ballet. He said, I feel the same way about that. Prayer and spirituality. And then he walks back to where he's sitting. I said, well, this is going to be a long day. So, okay, we're ready for the soup. We turn around to hand out the soup, and everyone comes by, and he comes by and grabs the bowl with us, goes over, sits, eats the soup. When he finished, he comes up, and he throws the bowl down near the dishes and walks out. I left there really mad, really mad. And I get on that bus going back to my little safe, secure environment in the Northeast. That, you know, I give up my whole day. I don't have to do this, you know. And, you know, I gave up my day. I went to the soup kitchen. I could have been studying Aquinas or Aristotle or going swimming or something. And this guy... didn't even thank me, for making the soup and stuff like that. You know, this is, I'm mad. And I stewed with that for a while. And then, sort of like when I was in the military there, and I had this enlightened moment as I was, you know, simulating I was killing someone, I said to myself, I get it. That guy was angry because he didn't like the relationship we were in. He didn't like being on the receiving end of this. Now, I don't know his story, don't know what was going on, you know, why he was in the situation he was in, whose fault it was, and so forth, blah, 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 blah. But the insight I got was he didn't like this relationship. You know, he's a young, pretty strong-looking guy, and I'm thinking, he's thinking, I shouldn't have to take this from this dude, you know, who's he, you know, give me the soup, and I'm in this situation. He was angry about a lot. But I thought it was about relationship, you know, and How do you fix that relationship? How do you do away with soup kitchens and food pantries, you know? That's our task, you know, to eliminate all of those things from our society so that people don't need to resort to them. So right relationship is how I understand justice in a general term. Now, you tack on the word social justice. So what do you mean by social justice? We've tried to say, and we'll keep repeating it, so social justice is not this interpersonal relationship that might have gone awry. You did something mean or awful or unjust to another person. But it's the system, the structures, society. There's something built into the system here that's unjust, okay, that leaves some people out, that discriminates or whatever. So social injustice. For the ancients, Aristotle, Aquinas, all these people, it came under the category of, and this is, I think, a little controversial in our world now, at least in this society, it came under the expression distributive justice. Distributive justice. So, in other words, how do we as a society distribute the resources that we have? How do we distribute them? Are they distributed fairly in our society is the question that social justice offers or raises up. So it's systemic, it's structural. Manuel asked me, give me some examples. He said, I get oppression and racism, and that's systemic evil. That's systemic evil that keeps people based on race or slash ethnicity down. Okay, that's one, but give me a few others. So I thought of others, you know. I worked with the farm workers in the 70s while in the seminary. Talk about a system of injustice. You know, these laborers, these farm laborers picking tomatoes and peaches and so forth for crappy wages and working in horrible and living in horrible conditions in these little trailer parks and so forth and being separated out from the rest of the world. A terrible system of social injustice. That whole, and so Cesar Chavez raises up and starts, you know, advocating for a different system for these farm laborers. You know, this whole voting rights thing, we just had, you know, a Supreme Court judgment on voting rights. You know, Dr. King, after the civil rights legislation in 64, and Johnson signed it and so forth, big victory. Well, King went right back, if you remember, to him and said, okay, Lyndon, now it's voting rights. And Johnson didn't want to do it. He said, go away, will you? I've already gone out on the limb once for you. Civil rights, you know, now you want more? Right, voting rights is the key, said King, and we're not going away till we get voting rights. So that, another question of systemic evil, social injustice, the attempt, once again, it appears to me of trying to suppress voting, you know, trying to keep those people away from the polls. Another example of systemic injustice. And one which jumps out to me all the time, which I think, you know, well, anyway, it's concrete, let's put it that way. And this gets to the question of economic democracy and economic dominance, and that is our tax structure. I think our tax structure is unbelievably unjust, okay? So look at, for example, just one piece of that tax structure, Social Security tax, if you've stayed on top of that. First of all, the Social Security tax in the last 30 years has gone up quite a bit. I'm not sure I'm right about this, but I believe 30, 35 years ago, it was only 1%, 1.5%, and it's now, what, 6.5% for the individual, 6.5% for the employer, and if you're self-employed, you pay both sides of it, 13% or whatever. Social Security tax. Now, the Social Security tax is a flat tax, as you know. Everyone pays the same percentage, flat tax. Regressive tax. No matter what you make, you pay the same percentage. And this is, I think, the worst part of it. And that ends at, what, 110,000? 110,000. Something like that. It keeps going up a little. So what that means is, the first 110,000 is taxed 6.5%, whatever it is, percent, 6.5%, 6.5%. For the first 110, after that, no tax. So not only is it a regressive tax, it's flat for everyone, but someone who makes 110,000 pays all of that in a Social Security tax. If you make 1 million, you only pay the first 110,000, and the rest is untaxed. So the Social Security system is breaking down. How about we alter the way, you know, we gain money from that? So to me, Manuel and others, another example of a grievous social injustice. It's built into the system, into the tax structure, and I think it's terribly unjust the way it distributes and spreads money around, okay? So those are some examples. At the talkback, we can, I'm sure you've got your own example. And by the way, this is always fascinating to me. Richard Nixon, who I don't ever remember anyone saying was a raging progressive politically, right? Richard Nixon, in 1970, through the influence of a fellow named Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was in his administration, advocated for a guaranteed national wage. Anyone remember that? A guaranteed national wage. He didn't like the welfare system, and Moynihan tried to help him figure out how to get rid of this whole welfare thing. So let's have a guaranteed national wage. And the second thing is national health care. Okay? Nixon, 1972. If you raise those two issues now, you're way left. So it's interesting how the political dialogue has changed. So, okay. So the topic for today, religion, politics, and democracy. So I think there's a lot of confusion around this question of how religion and politics should intersect. And there's a conflation, if you know that word, conflation, you know, a jumbling together, a collapsing into, between the notion of the separation of church and state and the intersection of religion and politics. And I think what often happens in discussions and dialogues when religious people raise political social issues, if you will, is people say, oh, no, this is the church-state, you're violating church-state separation. You know, if you go back to the Constitution, it's not very helpful, right? It's not very helpful because all we have in there is this First Amendment. And it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So you're free to practice whatever religion you want. And as I interpret it, there's no state religion. You know, we're not going to become, United States of America can't become a Muslim state or a Christian state or a Jewish state and so forth and so on. And that's what it says. It doesn't say separation of church and state here, at least those words. So most people think the first time that issue got raised was through Thomas Jefferson. He sent this letter to these Baptist ministers. There was a controversy going on in 1802 in Danbury, Connecticut. And he sent a letter and used the expression, this wall of separation. So people say, it was Jefferson. That's where it came from. Actually, an interesting religious figure named Roger Williams was the first one to raise it in the 1650s. And Roger Williams, unlike many people today and probably many you use, Williams' concern was not a religion intruding on the state, but the state intruding on religion. If you remember anything about Roger Williams, he got thrown out of Massachusetts. And he went to Rhode Island and so forth. And he wrote this little tract in 1650 or so, in which he said, religion is the garden, and politics is, or the state is the wilderness. And we've got to protect the garden from the wilderness, because the state will come in and impose its will. Like, you know, in the Puritan New England that threw him out, you know, where state, you know, church and state wasn't separated. So Williams, I think, raised this. And if you want to read something, and he's kind of a conservative, actually, and I think that's okay in my mind, but there's a guy at Yale named Stephen Carter, who's a lawyer, a law professor, a brilliant one, I think, African-American fellow, who writes a lot about religion and politics. And he's got a book, and it's on that list that I gave out, about the rights and wrongs of politics and religion. I think it's brilliant work. And it'll challenge us, because probably liberals won't like some of the things he said. But anyway, so, and then the Supreme Court didn't actually use the expression church-state separation. I think I'm right. I may be wrong. There may be scholars here that will boo me off the stage. But 1947, Hugo Black, in a ruling, there was this big controversy about using public buses to take Catholic kids to school, and could they do that, you know, use public buses? And so there was this big controversy about it. And Hugo Black talked about separation of church and state and how it applied and so forth. So then that expression came up again. And now it's a more common expression in the parlance. But what I want to say about it is simply that, as I understand it, separation of church and state is no state religion. No state religion. Intersection of religion and politics, unavoidable. Unavoidable. Why do I say that? Because for some of us, religion, not all, but for some of us, religion is where we get our values, some of us. And so how can you say to a religious person whose values come out of the biblical tradition or the Buddhist tradition or the humanist or whatever, how can you say to that person, well, you can't bring those values into the public square because that's religious? So what I want to say, and we can really yak about it, I guess, in the talk back, is separation of church and state, brilliant, important, no state religion. Intersection of religion and politics, get used to it, folks. It's just part of, you know, the situation we live in, and it's going to happen, and I don't think it can be avoided. So just at least to put that out there, that church-state separation is not religion-politics separation, in my mind, at any rate. So moving right along. Now, again, the liberation theologians have helped me a lot with this. Started in Latin America, spread to Africa and Asia, and has all sorts of forms to it, you know, feminist form and environmental form, theology of liberation. One of the liberation theologians actually talked about the importance of political holiness, of holy behavior in the political arena, which I think is a very interesting expression. And Oscar Romero, this bishop, who, the reason he got shot, by the way, Oscar Romero in 1980, is that after many of his friends, priests and nuns, were slaughtered by the government of El Salvador, first of all, he wrote Jimmy Carter, by the way, 1979, a letter, and saying, President Carter, your government is sending money to this oppressive government in my country. Would you stop doing it, please? And that struggle went on, by the way, for 10 years. We finally got the Congress to vote to stop supporting the Salvadoran government. But in 1979, Oscar Romero, this non-political, apolitical fellow, this bishop, wrote a letter to Carter. Your money is being used to kill my people. Would you stop sending it? Then the next year, so that was the first strike against him. Then the next year, Romero went on the radio. His Sunday Mass sometimes was broadcast on the radio all through El Salvador, and he went on the radio, and in a sermon he said to the Salvadoran soldiers, put your guns down, please. You are killing your own brothers and sisters. Please stop doing that, soldiers. And within some weeks he was shot dead because he addressed the system, this systemic government oppressive system in his country, and he had to be done away with. So Oscar Romero said shortly before he died, this apolitical, believe me, a conservative fellow, kind of bookish, he was appointed by the Vatican because he was safe. Oscar Romero said shortly before his death, religion held with deep convictions leads to political involvement. The Vatican was horrified. But it came out of his experience of oppression by this system, this government. Now, in our own world, so back to James Luther Adams, one of my Unitarian Universalist heroes, this giant who died in 1994. Adams is brilliant on this idea, I think brilliant. And you can read his works. I know we don't have them in the bookstore this week, but Beacon Press has them and the UU bookstore and so forth. So Adams, among other things, writes about where this whole notion of democracy came from. And, you know, we think of the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and so forth. Well, we could think about Athens, I suppose we go that far back, but in the more modern era. But Adams likes to talk about the Reformation, democracy and the Reformation, and most specifically what he calls the Radical Reformation or the left wing of the Reformation. And the left wing of the Reformation is where James Luther Adams and others would root Unitarian Universalist in the left wing. And so the left wing would not be Lutherans, Episcopalians, well, the Episcopal Reformation was a little later, but Lutherans and Calvinists and so forth. The left wing were the Mennonites and the Quakers and those folks who actually, you might say, were kind of anti-clerical, but they were for democratization of the religious community, okay? And so they were suspicious of authority and hierarchy, and so we can fit into that very nicely, right? And my ministerial friends will say, oh, geez, Art, you had to raise that one. Come on. We're trying to get over that. But no. So the left wing of the Reformation was this democratized religion. And the idea was that, and Luther Adams repeats this over and over again, what he calls the prophethood and the priesthood of all believers. That's what the left wing of the Reformation was all about. This democratized religious body, any sort of ministerial involvement as the minister is, you know, part of the process and all, but we're democratized. And so all people are prophets. All people are priests in this notion. So bringing it up to the more modern day, William Ellery Channing raised this issue of the importance in democracy of what he calls voluntary associations. Voluntary associations. That's where churches fit in democracy. We're a voluntary association. So Channing raised that, and de Tocqueville, the French philosopher who wrote about the history of America, raised it. And then a century later, James Luther Adams develops it. And probably, I think I'm right about this, there's no ethicist or theologian in the 20th century of the United States of America who says more about it. James Luther Adams is the man on voluntary associations. So here's the situation. In our structure, you have the government over here, and ever more so, you have corporations as these big power structures, corporations and government. And then over here, you have individuals, each one of us. In the middle, would James Luther Adams would say, is civil society, what he calls, what many call, civil society. And for a democracy to function well, that civil society needs to be strong and vibrant and have some authority and clout and power. Civil society. And that's where churches fit in as voluntary associations. When civil society is weak and people, if you will, let's say it simply, aren't joining groups to advocate for certain issues, and they're just, you know, kind of in their homes, as de Tocqueville would talk about, people withdrawing into their private lives and living with their families and not being part of associations and groups, then democracy gets weaker and weaker. And the government and the corporations make all the decisions, and individuals don't have a shot. So we need these strong, powerful, voluntary associations, like churches, to advocate for democracy. And most particularly, what we need, because there are different kinds of voluntary associations. There are some that are special interests, and there are some that are for the general good. Churches, synagogues, mosques ought to be voluntary associations for the general good, for human betterment, for the common good, if you will. And so are groups like Amnesty International, maybe, and ACLU or something like that. Then you have these special interest groups that have their own little concern, like NRA, maybe. You know, that's concerned about guns, but... And maybe they think that's for the common good. So if they were here, they'd probably say, no, that's for the common good. Okay, we'd have that discussion. That's fair, all right? But I think their issue is on the narrow side. So civil society is very important for democracy to function, and churches have a key role. So this big movement that I've spent a lot of time in recently, and that we have about 150 to 200 in churches out of our 1,000 involved in, I mentioned it yesterday, PIN in Pittsburgh, Bread in Columbus. These community organizing groups are a voluntary association for the common good. We take on issues and we try to advocate, particularly for people who are disenfranchised. So for Adams, building up civil society, so key, otherwise democracy is lost. You know, Margaret Thatcher once said she didn't believe in civil society. She said there's no such thing. They're government and they're individuals. So, interesting thought. Does civil society really exist? I think it's essential to democracy. So, the last thing I want to touch upon this morning, and again, we can elaborate at the talk back and so forth, is a very, very key issue. So, okay, so we're trying to build up civic society. We acknowledge there may be disagreements. I understand that. But this bully pulpit is acknowledging that religion and politics can intersect, that we need to be, as religious organizations, a voluntary group working for the common good and human betterment, and that's what helps democracy work. So then the issue becomes, and James Luther Adams, again, is phenomenal on this, as a theologian, as an ethicist, the question of power. Because nothing gets done without access to power. And voluntary associations, civil people working for civil society, know that they're up against powerful forces. Actually, St. Paul, in one of his letters, talked about the powers and the principalities of evil, you know, that dominate us. And so we need to deal with the question of power, which is very difficult, I think, for a lot of us to think about. It seems dirty, tainted, power. We don't do power, right? But Adams says the central social ethical issue of the day is the use and the abuse of power. And so he took this, the Beatitudes in the Newer Testament, and he said in one of his articles, blessed are the powerful. Blessed are the powerful. Now, obviously, there needs to be lots of checks and balances on power, how it's used. You know, what are the ends? What are the goals of the use of power? But in order to make social change for the common good, we need to deal with power. Now, Adams is phenomenal on this, but not any better than Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, in one of his last addresses to the Southern Christian Leadership Council, talked about power. And he was talking about the struggle for African-American liberation, ongoing struggle. And he said, power is so important for freedom and liberation. And this is what King says. These are incredible words. To me, they're incredible. Now, a lot of us are preachers, says King, and all of us have our moral convictions and concerns, and so often we have problems with power. There is nothing wrong with power if power is used correctly. You see, what happened is that some of our philosophers got off base. And one of the great problems of history is that the concepts of love and power have usually been contrasted as opposites, polar opposites, so that love is identified with the resignation of power and power with the denial of love. It was this misinterpretation that caused Nietzsche, the philosopher, the German philosopher, who was We've been trying to avoid that, but what are you going to do? Nietzsche, who was a philosopher of the will to power, to reject the Christian concept of love. It was this same misinterpretation which induced Christian theologians to reject the Nietzschean philosophy of the will to power in the name of the Christian idea of love. Now, we've got to get this right, says King. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. And this is what we must see as we move on. So, Adams says all the same things about power and love. The way Adams says it is, and we're getting back to how we ground our social justice work. Adams says our social justice work and the importance of power, of gaining power, needs to be grounded in love, or it's lost, as religious people, as Unitarian Universalists. So, where this got confused, you probably all remember that, aphorism is the right word, I'm not sure. Lord Acton, remember this fellow, this English statesman, in 1870 he said, power corrupts and ultimate power. What? Absolute power corrupts absolutely, Acton said. Well, do you know what the context of that was? Anyone? Well, Lord Acton was an English Catholic, and he was talking about the Vatican. It's really fascinating. Do you know in 1870 what happened in the Catholic Church? Papal infallibility. So that's what Acton was talking about. Isn't that fascinating? But as King alludes to, and that's what he's talking about, that became this generic expression, power corrupts. Oh, we don't want power. It's dirty. It's abusive. You know, it corrupts us all, absolutely. James Luther Adams turns that around and said, you know what really corrupts? Powerlessness corrupts. The lack of power. And powerlessness corrupts absolutely. So he flipped that statement. So lacking power is what is corruptive. And that leads to despair and disillusion and probably lots of crime as well. Let's face it. Lack of power. So it's not the question of how do we avoid power. We don't deal with power because we're religious people. We're too nice. We're from Minnesota, right? We're all nice. Do you know, an incredible example of the exercise of power for good, in my opinion, there's this video about the community organizing movement when Alinsky, Saul Alinsky from Chicago, this great Jewish activist, worked with churches, even though he wasn't a believer, but he knew that this was in Chicago where he started. He knew that's where the power was, all these immigrant churches, right? And the bishops there knew that Alinsky could help all these immigrants, poor immigrants, get some rights. So he then went off to Rochester in 1965, and it was a horrible situation. Eastman Kodak was the big employer there, and the black unemployment rate in Rochester in 1965 was like 35%. It was a bad situation. And they kept asking Eastman Kodak for some jobs, and getting nowhere. So Alinsky, all these African-American ministers got together, and they went to Malcolm X. These black ministers went to Malcolm X and said, who can help us get organized? And Malcolm X said, the only guy I know who can do this is Saul Alinsky, you know, this white Jewish guy. And the black minister said, what can this white man do for us? Come on. You know, da, da, da. But Malcolm X said, this is the guy. He knows what to do. So Alinsky shows up, gets them organized, and they decided to buy stocks in Eastman Kodak so that they could have a voice in the annual stockholder meeting. And so they bought some stocks, and they wanted to get on the agenda, and they were being kind of put off. And they finally got on the agenda, but they were the last item when everything else was going to be decided. So they had no power, right? So they had no choice. So what did they do? They disrupted the meeting. And by the way, James Luther Adams has an article, a wonderful article called Disrupting the Meeting. Now, we're all nice, and we don't like to do that. It's impolite to disrupt meetings. But when you're powerless and you have no other choice, sometimes you have to do it. So in the early part of the meeting, didn't they open up the doors, all these African-American ministers, and they marched down to the mic, which is in the middle. And they said, Mr. Chairman, we have our issue. We want to know, will you give us jobs? And, of course, the fellow up there is saying, you have to wait your turn. We're not waiting our turn. We're at the end of the list. Everyone will be gone. Will you give us jobs? And we'll be back in 1 hour to get your answer. So they stormed out. So this was great theater. You know, community organizing at its best is great theater. Really, it's wonderful theater. So you have to have a sense of drama to be a good community organizer. So 1 hour later, they storm back in. Right. What is your answer, Mr. Chairman? And he said, the answer is no. So the minister said, well, it's going to be a long, hot summer. Long, hot summer. So, of course, the whole summer, they demonstrated Eastman Kodak, you know, boycott Eastman Kodak and so forth. So finally, a deal was made. And Eastman Kodak said, okay, we'll create some jobs. So they interviewed in the film that I saw one of the now retired board members. And they said to him, well, what do you think of what these people did? And he said, you know, I didn't like it at the time, he said, but I guess that group was a necessary evil. Isn't that interesting? I guess that group was a necessary evil. In other words, I didn't like it. I didn't like the way they did it. That's not the way we run our meetings and so forth. But he was acknowledging that Eastman Kodak wasn't budging until they stormed into the meeting and said it's going to be a long, hot summer. And Eastman got... So that is, in my view, and we learn this in community organizing, a use of power for common good. And you'd like to think you never have to storm into a meeting because Eastman Kodak of the world would say, of course, this is a terrible situation. We have to create jobs. But when it's a last resort, you know, like a just war, it's a last resort. And you storm that meeting and you say, we demand it or we'll boycott and blah, 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 blah. So it's an example of the use of power, I think. So when we talk about this issue of religion and politics and people get nervous and uncomfortable, I think a better way to approach it, and the UUA uses this verbiage, and I think it's quite appropriate and not not a way to evade things, but I think it's really, it gets social justice into the center of the congregation once again. It's part of our public ministry. Think of it as part of our public ministry. So we have pastoral care, as we said the other day. We have religious education. We have celebration and worship when we gather, and we have a public ministry. You know, we talk about ethical, moral issues, and we act on them for the common good. And I rest my case. Now, announcements coming, folks.
Sorry, you guys. I just want to let you know, you don't even have to sit down again. I'll be fast. We want to make sure that everybody knows exactly how bad the heat is going to be today. It's going to be hotter than yesterday. There is a heat advisory this afternoon from noon until 9 p.m., and the heat index expected is 104 degrees. So, drink water. It's okay. Crap. I'll say it too. drink a lot of water and know where the AC is. Let me give you two tips if you don't already know them for moving around on campus and finding some AC on your way to places. The library right next door to us, which I think is open until 5 or 6, has a beautiful atrium space in there that is cool and has some seating. And it's when you go inside, if you haven't been in there, you go upstairs to the second level to get into the library proper. But there's a lobby area that has some seating in there. It's a nice place to sit and talk. It's very cool. Likewise, there is a lobby at the art gallery right next door to that. Gund Gallery has another air-conditioned lobby, nice and cool and shaded. And you know all of the other places that we've been using. So we're probably going to spend a lot of time indoors this afternoon. So. Awesome, thank you. 5:30 is when the library closes. Thank you very much. Have a good day.